From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Today, the ponies will race in the 134th Kentucky Derby. Ahead on Only a Game, Jenny Reese picks them as she sees them. Also, why some professional bull riders have opted for safety over style, the latest NBA playoff news, and a conversation with Lee Montville, author of The Mysterious Montague, A True Tale of Hollywood, Golf, and Armed Robbery. Also ahead, the roar of the gutter balls, the smell of the beer, stars of the Broadway stage, take to the bowling lanes.
We all want to be John Turturro from The Big Lebowski, but we just don't have the nerve to start slinking around and doing all that stuff. But maybe later on we'll throw in a bit of style.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There has been a theme of dark colors running through Kentucky Derby Week. Big Brown, Bob Black Jack, Cool Coal Man, unless maybe it's Soothsaying, Z Fortune, Visionaire, Court Vision, or maybe nicknames, Cowboy Cal, Dennis of Cork, Colonel John. Jenny Reese, my radio companion each year on this day of days in Kentucky, joins me now, and together we will try to recapture the glory of previous Derby discussions, although recapture the glory with E.T. Baird in the irons was a 20-to-1 shot the last time I looked, so maybe not, especially as Mr. Baird has never ridden in a Derby before. Huh. Anyway, Jenny, welcome back to the program.
Great, Bill. I wish I'd talked to you earlier. I could use the way you've got so many Derby horses into one sentence in my advance.
Yeah, I get a little bit obsessed this time of year, I guess. But everybody seems to think Big Brown is a legitimate favorite. He's 3-for-3, which certainly beats 2-and-1 or 1-and-2 or 0-for-3. But how much can be determined from just three races?
Well, that's the big thing. He's going up against a lot of history. In fact, it's been since 1950 that a horse won the Derby in its fourth career start. He's won very easily. His smallest margin of victory was 5 lengths in the Florida Derby. So the big question is, what happens if somebody actually gives him competition? And jockey Kent DeZormo even said, you know, that's a good question. I don't know. But they think from having the far outside post, post 20, which hasn't won the Derby since 1929, they say, well, at least he'll be out of traffic problems there. He may be way out of traffic problems.
Maybe in another state.
He might be in Indiana, that's right.
The second favorite in the morning line is Colonel John. He's won 4 races, but he's also lost 2. He apparently likes the surface at Churchill Downs. Had a great workout there. How much does that matter?
That can make a big difference. Barbaro came here and had a terrific work. He was a horse who looked like he might be a grass horse. He also won the Florida Derby. But Colonel John has never raced on conventional dirt, and that's the question with him, even though, as you said, he had a monster workout. I don't think it'll be an issue. He's absolutely bred for the dirt. But that might be the thing that keeps some people off him. They say it's not so much how the horse's footing handles the change in surface from the synthetic tracks that they race on in California, but getting that dirt kick back into their face for the first time might cause some horses to become tentative or to think maybe there's a better way to make a living than running into that stuff. But I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if Colonel John at post time today at 6:04 ends up the betting favorite. There's a lot of buzz about him.
Let's stay with this business about the surface for just a minute. Whatever else one might say about the Kentucky Derby, it will, by golly, sound like a horse race. Churchill Downs has stayed with the dirt track rather than adopting one of the synthetic surfaces, which mute the sound of the thundering herd, no little and quite some, as Damon Runyon might have written. Are you a traditionalist as far as track surfaces are concerned?
I'm a traditionalist when it comes to the Kentucky Derby, that's for sure. Hmm. And that is one reason to segue into another issue is why you won't see me say the Kentucky Derby presented by Yum Brands. I love the sandy loam here at Churchill Downs. It has been good for 134 years. Maybe there will be a time when they go to a synthetic track, but I think it's quite a ways off. There's still a lot to be learned about the synthetic tracks and how they hold up over time. But it is the big question of this Kentucky Derby, and it arrived, this question, much faster than I thought it would. A year ago, I was joking, well, everybody used to always ask the trainers, do you think your horse can handle the mile and a quarter? It's going to be some year, do you think they can handle the dirt? Mm. Well, that's what's happening this year, because California mandated all of its major tracks be a synthetic surface. So we have horses like Colonel John and Bob Blackjack that have never raced before on dirt.
One of the recurring stories in the Derby seems to be the tale of the trainer who's won everything but the big one. Todd Pletcher, for example, is 0-19 at the Kentucky Derby. He's got Cowboy Cal and Mamba running today. How do they look?
Well, they're two horses. They finished 1-2 in the Bluegrass Stakes at Keeneland, which is a polytrack surface, another faux track, artificial track. And the question is, will they be at a disadvantage on the dirt? Now, Todd Pletcher has set all kinds of records, and as you said, his record up for 0-19 is one I'm sure he'd rather not have. I'm sure he would like to point out it's only been over 7 years that he accrued that, but it is the most defeats by a trainer without a win in this race.
The only filly running in the Derby is 8 Bells. I understand that Hillary Clinton supports 8 Bells. I'm not sure exactly why, but can 8 Bells join the exclusive club of female Derby winners that includes Winning Colors and, of course, the utterly inappropriately named Regret?
It wouldn't be a shocker if she did. This is not regarded as the deepest group of colts this year, even though I think maybe we're being a little premature about that. And I think also they suffer in comparison to a really spectacular group last year. And I think that's one reason 8 Bells is in here. The thinking is that if you look at the speed figures, she stacks up as well. But she has her own history to buck. She has never raced a mile and eighth. And you go back 57 years before a horse won the Derby without first racing a mile and eighth.
Mm-hmm.
And she also hasn't raced against colts before. And the three fillies that did win the Kentucky Derby, Regret, Genuine Risk, and Winning Colors, all faced males first.
Each year at this time, Jenny, numbers of naysayers natter on about what's wrong with the Kentucky Derby. The field's too big, the horses are too young for the test, the pomp overwhelms the sporting side of the event, and so on and so on. Would you like to remind us of what's right about the first Saturday in May?
Well, there's a lot I could add there. I thought you were going to let me opine about what else is wrong, and I was going to add $7 beers to the list. It is great, and they've had terrific crowds all week, and the weather's been fantastic at Churchill Downs, and it is racing really at its finest. I would not want to see them cut the field size down to 14 horses. That's part of what makes it the toughest. It's the best race in the world. It's the toughest race in the world to win. If you look through the charts, there's a lot of great champions that have gone down in defeat in the Kentucky Derby.
All right, enough filler. The winner, please.
Colonel John. He is named for Iraqi war veteran Colonel John Guider. You know, it'd be a really nice feel-good story, but he's a grand-looking horse. He had that spectacular workout. He has very good form. He came home very fast in the Santa Anita Derby. He's bred for a mile and a quarter. Besides the fact that it'd be a great story, I think he's the best horse.
Jenny Reese is the most successful handicapper of my acquaintance. She has picked every Derby winner since, 1993 when we began this program, something like that. Well done, Jenny, and thanks very much.
All right, Bill.
Rodeo is a sport based on tradition, but according to some, modern helmets are impinging on bull riding tradition, even while most agree that they help prevent serious head injuries. Only a Game's Greg Eklund recently put on his reporter's fedora and has more on the story.
At this March's Professional Bull Riders Tour stop in Kansas City, a mechanical lift thrusts the world's best bull riders into the spotlight during introductions as rock and roll blares from giant PA speakers and fireworks light up the inside of the Sprint Center. There's no Willie Nelson discouraging mamas from letting their sons grow up to be cowboys, and there are fewer cowboy hats than in years past. When the 2008 PBR Tour began in January, 40% of the riders wore helmets, up from 5% just 10 years ago.
I'm a proponent of helmet use, and I encourage all of them to wear it. Maybe I'm enough of a cowboy that I just don't feel like they ought to be made to do it if they really don't want to.
That's Dr. Tandy Freeman, the Professional Bull Riders Medical Director, who grew up in the rodeo culture of West Texas. Dr. Freeman hopes the day will come when every bull rider wears a helmet, but for now, his approach remains old school.
The best way to convince a cowboy to do something is to get him to believe that it's his choice and that he's making the choice because it's in his best interest.
Helmets are not mandatory for bull riders. 25-year-old Luke Snyder of Raymore, Missouri, prefers not to wear one. Snyder set a PBR record last year for most consecutive events. At March's Cabela's Classic, he competed in his 210th straight rodeo.
I wouldn't know the first thing about putting one on, so I don't know. If Tandy would ever tell me that he thought I needed to wear one, like he'd tell someone else, that's the day I'd strap it on. But other than that, you know, just my cowboy hat's what I wear so far.
Snyder recently surpassed $1 million in career earnings. Though he has yet to swap his Stetson for safer headgear, he foresees the day when helmets will become mandatory.
You know, every year the bulls are getting bigger and bigger. And we had a wreck that happened the other day with one of our top guys, J.B. Mooney, and bull stepped on his helmet. And I was in the locker room when they brought the helmet in, and it definitely, if he wouldn't have been wearing it, it would have been a pretty bad deal.
When you see that, doesn't that make any kind of impact on you or an impression on you?
Well, from my standpoint, is if you start worrying about, all you're worried about is getting your head stepped on, then you're not worried about riding bulls too bad. You know, anytime you play a sport like this or a game like this, you know, you're taking the risk to get hurt.
There was a day when Ross Coleman, who makes his home outside Portland, Oregon, would never have considered wearing a helmet while riding a bull. He's worn it since the beginning of the season in January, but in the March 3rd issue of Sports Illustrated, there's a photo of Coleman with his feet in the air and his helmeted head hitting the ground.
All BS aside, a long time ago, I would have been the first guy to maybe cuss a guy about wearing a helmet, but I just figured it's a good idea for me and my career. I figured it's a smart move for me because I've had so many injuries for my head.
Coleman, who turned 30 in early March, has earned almost $1.2 million in his career. Still, he says, he'd like to continue professionally for 5 more years. When he addressed the International Rodeo Medicine Conference in Oklahoma City last January, Dr. Freeman addressed the issue of how to convince bull riders to wear helmets.
When you can hone things down to a point where you can prove to them that they'll get on more bulls and that they'll have a better chance of making money, they start to listen and they'll start to do the things that we can show them will benefit them in terms of injury prevention and their own health.
The conference was organized by Dr. Mark Brandenburg, who practices emergency medicine at the University of Oklahoma College of Medicine in Tulsa. Dr. Brandenburg's research has helped pave the way for acceptance of bull riders to wear helmets. His data indicates that the rate of injury in bull riding is higher than any other contact sport, and that helmets do reduce the chance of head injuries. He became passionate about his studies of rodeo athletes as the result of a 1995 experience during his residency training.
I took care of a young man who was 15 or 16 years old from Colorado who was competing in the National High School Rodeo Championships here in Oklahoma, and who was unfortunately severely injured by in the head and neck and was killed. And we took care of him in the emergency department. And it was after that patient that I began asking questions and subsequently, shortly thereafter, began doing research on the helmet issue.
Dr. Brandenburg says he's pleased with recent progress, but that a barrier still exists in the culture of rodeo, the sport in which the riders can be just as stubborn as the beasts they ride. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Kansas City.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The winner never remembers winning. Such is the fate of those who prevail in the annual Crying Sumo Contest in Tokyo. In this year's competition, 84 babies born during the past year were held up in the air 2 at a time by sumo wrestlers. The baby who cries first is declared the winner. If both babies begin screaming simultaneously, the louder tot triumphs. Crying sumo is an entertainment, of course. Who wouldn't find the competitive wailing of 4 score and more babies enthralling? But the competition is also held to pray for the healthy growth of the children. And it's probably safe to assume that the losers never remember losing.
You said, cry to me.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a tale of bunkers and bandits set on the golf courses of the 1930s in Hollywood. But first, the NBA playoffs are in full stride, and here to update this year's seemingly interminable opening round is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
Last night, the Atlanta Hawks evened their series against the Boston Celtics. That series stands at 3-3. Is this shaping up as one of the biggest playoff upsets in NBA history?
Well, the Celtics probably are thinking about the Dallas Mavericks last year and wondering if this is going to become an annual thing where the team with the best record in the NBA gets bounced in the first round by an 8 seed. I don't think it's going to happen, but I'm sure Doc Rivers isn't too happy to have to be playing another 48 minutes against Josh Smith and Joe Johnson and Al Horford. I think he just assumed get on to round two.
The Cleveland Cavaliers sent the Washington Wizards home last night. They win that series 4-2. Can LeBron James keep it rolling long enough to get his team back into the finals?
I don't think so. Not this year. The Cavs have been saying ever since LeBron got there that they're going to put some pieces around him to give him some help. But every year in the playoffs, it seems like he has to go for 35, 40 a night, get 12 rebounds and 8 assists for them to win. And if he doesn't do that, they lose because there just isn't that much around him. I mean, Ilgauskas is decent, but not great. Ben Wallace is a shadow of his former self. I just think LeBron is still a one-man gang, the best one-man gang in the NBA, but that's not going to be enough to get past the Celtics.
Also last night, Utah closed out their series against the Houston Rockets. Do they stand any chance against the Lakers in round two?
Well, I'll tell you, the Lakers, we're definitely rooting for the Rockets because while I don't think the Jazz can beat the Lakers 4 times in 7 games, I think they can push that series to 6 or 7, and I think the Lakers would much rather have had an easier time against T-Mac and Rafer Alston and those cats as opposed to Deron Williams, Mehmet Okur, Carlos Boozer, Andre Kirilenko. I think the Jazz are really well coached by Jerry Sloan. They're disciplined, and they wear you down. I think the Lakers win that series, but they're not going to have any fun playing the Jazz.
Philadelphia gave Detroit a bit of a scare in the first round, but the Pistons finally did prevail. The Eastern Conference seems to be improving all the time. Are we going to see better Eastern Conference playoffs in the future as teams not named the Pistons or the Celtics begin to develop a little bit?
Well, I think that the West is getting a little bit older. If you look at the 7 of the last 8 MVPs have come from players currently playing in the West. Tim Duncan's getting older. Steve Nash is getting older. Allen Iverson's getting older. Shaquille O'Neal's getting older. I think that spate of MVP awards is going to move into their decline phase, or already has moved into their decline phase. And you're going to start to see some players like Josh Smith of the Atlanta Hawks, Joe Johnson of the Atlanta Hawks, Deshaun Stevenson, Caron Butler, and Anton Jameson in Washington, some really good young nuclei in the Eastern Conference, and I think that disparity is going to level out in the next few years.
The Orlando-Detroit series begins today. So does the Magic stand a chance in the second round against the Pistons?
2 weeks ago, I would have said no, but watching how much trouble the Pistons had with the Sixers and watching how little trouble the Magic had with the Raptors, I'd almost make that series a coin flip. I don't think anybody has an answer right now for Dwight Howard, and Hedo Turkoglu is not the same player I remember watching in Sacramento. That guy is outstanding. I don't think the Pistons got a wake-up call in the first round, but I don't know. That could easily go 7 games, that Magic-Pistons series.
Dallas managed to win only 1 game against the New Orleans Hornets before bowing out. Should we call that unexpected?
Well, it was unexpected to me. I thought the Mavericks would win that series, a veteran team against, excuse the pun, the Green Hornets.
That's terrific. That's why we have you on the show. That's magnificent.
The Magic, I mean, the Mavericks just didn't show up. I really feel like it was a sad sort of end to the Jason Kidd as all-star phase of his career. You know, his clothesline of Gennaro Pargo is kind of a sad way to be remembered, and it was the absolute low point in his career. He couldn't do anything with Chris Paul. Chris Paul got wherever he wanted to be on the floor, really embarrassed him, and I think he took some of that humiliation out on Gennaro Pargo's head. And then Avery Johnson gets fired, and Josh Howard gets an early start on his self-medicating in the offseason.
Was the Spurs' elimination of the Suns the result of a subpar maladjusted Shaquille O'Neal, or was Phoenix simply inferior to San Antonio?
I think San Antonio is a better team, a better playoff team, but I am laying all the blame for that series on Mike D'Antoni's failure to foul in the final seconds of the first overtime of Game 1. I think that series was literally lost in that moment when they allowed Tim Duncan to toe up the tying three-pointer to send it into a second overtime. If they had fouled Manu Ginobili when he dribbled into the lane, they would have won Game 1, and that series would have gone seven games.
The Spurs and the Hornets begin their second-round series today. The normally unflappable Spurs have to be at least a little bit worried, I'd think.
Well, the interesting thing about the Spurs, as Tony Parker reminded us in round one, he was the finals MVP last year. Tony Parker is almost never included in the argument about the great point guards in the NBA. Definitely seems like Steve Nash, Chris Paul, and Deron Williams dominate that argument. Well, there's a guy who plays in San Antonio named Tony Parker who scores at will in the playoffs. And I don't think – I mean, I underestimated the Hornets in the first round, but now they're really moving up in class, and I don't think that series goes more than five games.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA, among other things, for FoxSports.com. Kevin, thanks again for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
If you're a technophobe like me, you may wonder what a podcast is. Let's consult the dictionary. Pod, a school of marine mammals, such as seals, whales, or dolphins. Cast, to throw with force or hurl. So if you'd like to throw dolphins with force, hurl whales, or listen to all of Only a Game's weekly offerings, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. John Montague was said to have intentionally knocked a bird off a telephone wire with a golf shot. He was said to have lifted the back end of a car and held it up while a friend changed the tire. Witnesses swear Montague frequently heaved Oliver Hardy of Laurel and Same off the ground and onto the bar at the Lakeside Golf Club with one hand. These are only a few of the reasons Lee Montville was drawn to the story of John Montague. I haven't even mentioned the armed robbery. Lee Montville, author of The Mysterious Montague, A True Tale of Hollywood, Golf, and Armed Robbery, joins me now in the studio. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill.
I'm not sure how to begin at the beginning with this story, but since this is a sports show, talk a little bit about John Montague, a.k.a. The Mysterious Montague, and what he could do on a golf course when he was at the height of his powers in the 1930s.
Well, he was a guy who showed up around Hollywood. It was the start of the Depression, and people were pouring into California from all over. And he wasn't a particularly big guy in a tall sense. He was only about 5'10", 5'11". But he was very squat and powerful. He had powerful hands. Everybody talked about his muscles and his hands. He had special clubs that he'd had made up. His driver was twice the size of the normal driver, and he could hit the ball 300, 325, 350 yards at a time when nobody was doing that. He showed up and started playing around the public courses, and he became the friend of the rich and famous.
Bing Crosby.
Johnny,
Oliver Hardy.
Johnny Weissmuller. All these golf. W.C.
Fields.
W.C. Fields,
beautiful.
W.C. Fields. He joined this Lakeside Golf Club where they all played golf, and he had a whole repertoire of tricks and things. He would open the window just a little bit and then proceed to chip balls through the opening. He was always lifting things. He was the strongest guy anybody'd seen in a lot of ways. He was always lifting cars, you know. The car's in your way, I'll get that car.
I'll move
out
it.
Here.
Yeah.
The cars were lighter those days. You have to say that, too.
When John Montague's Hollywood golfing pals played with him game after game, weekend after weekend, were they ever suspicious about Montague's serious reluctance to have his picture taken, let alone compete in golf tournaments where he might have attracted attention?
Well, later, when everything fell apart, they all said that they weren't. You know, that Hollywood was a place where people came from everywhere. And there were rumors about him because he was so charismatic. You know, some people thought he grew up in California. Some people thought he was the son of some British duke or something. He was a mysterious figure.
Is it accurate to say that John Montague would have remained a mysterious figure, and a happily mysterious figure, I assume, if it hadn't been for the most famous sports writer of Montague's day, Grantland Rice?
Yes, very much so. I think he would have been like a local phenomenon. Most golf courses have the great golfer at their course. So he would have been, I think, one of those country club guys, you know, famous for his tricks and the weird things he did. If Grantland Rice hadn't belonged to this Lakeside Golf Club, he was there for like 2 months a year, and he started playing with this Montague. He'd heard about him, of course, from all the other members. Grantland Rice was a very good golfer. He was like a low handicap golfer, and he'd played with all the greats of the game. He was a personal friend of Bobby Jones. He was a personal friend of Walter Hagen, all the great players. And he got playing with Montague, and he saw these drives. And Rice kept watching this guy, and the guy would keep shooting 63. And Rice said, "Oh, my God, this is the greatest golfer I've ever seen. He's better than Bobby Jones. He's better than Walter Hagen. You know, what a thing." And he wrote a column about John Montague. And then he wrote another column, and then he said, "The best amateur golfer in the country won't be the U.S. Amateur Champion. It'll be John Montague." All of a sudden, John Montague's name got more and more famous, and the intrepid people at Time Magazine, then a very young magazine, they said, "Let's get a look at this guy and let's get a picture of this guy." And so they sent a reporter out, and they sent a photographer with a telephoto lens. The magazine showed up, and back in the Adirondacks, upstate New York, a couple of state cops looked at the picture and read the story, and they said, "That's the son of a gun who robbed the Hanna restaurant 7 years ago."
Right. So as it turned out, Mr. Montague had begun his life as Laverne Moore in upstate New York, and he had a reputation there, but not as a golfer.
Right. He did crazy things there, but sometimes the crazy things backfired. He had played minor league baseball. He had tried out for the Yankees. He had tried out for John McGraw and the New York Giants. But he had gone to the dark side, and it was Prohibition. He'd gone with the bootleggers and got involved in this robbery, allegedly got involved in this robbery.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. It's a pretty good story because Laverne Moore's golf clubs and luggage turned up in the trunk of a car which was used in an armed robbery back in 1930. Whether Laverne Moore himself was also in that car became the question that a jury in Elizabethtown, New York, had to answer 7 years after the crime was committed. Was it simply a case of that jury having to decide which convicted armed robber to believe?
Pretty much. There were four guys, and when they held up this restaurant and bound and gagged everybody and took the money, about $700, they split into two cars, and one of the cars was this red coupe that was flying down the road, and the cops gave chase because they thought they were bootleggers. They're flying as fast as they can, which is like maybe 55, 60 at the time, and it's the middle of the night, and the passenger, he taps out the lights so that the cops can't see their brake lights. But that also taps out the headlights. The driver can't see where he's going. He hits an abutment. The car goes flying. The passenger dies, and the money's all over the ground, and the cops come upon it, not knowing what it's all about. And like you say, it got down to one convicted robber saying that that Montague was with him and the other guy saying that he wasn't with him. But when the cops, like 2 days later, went to his house to get him, he had taken off that morning and wasn't spotted again till he was trying to putt for the par in Time magazine 7 years later.
I'm speaking with Lee Montville, author of The Mysterious Montague. You're listening to Only a Game. The judge in the trial of Laverne Moore / John Montague was outraged by the jury's decision. What about the people attending the trial?
Oh, they all loved him, you know, because it was 7 years later. Prohibition was long gone. He had this guy, Noonan, from Albany, who had defended Dutch Schultz and had gotten Dutch Schultz off.
Twice
for tax evasion. And his basic game plan was he brought Dutch in real early, like a month before, and made him, you know, give a few dollars to the church and patronize the local merchants and go to the bars and buy drinks. And, you know, by the time the trial came, you couldn't get a jury up there that didn't think Dutch Schultz was the greatest guy in the world. And that was kind of the case with Montague. He followed the same game plan and followed it quite well.
Once John Montague was a free man, lots of people, probably including Montague himself, expected that he would emerge as a great, if not actually magical, talent on the golf course. Why didn't that happen, Lee?
Well, he got a business manager, and they said he was going to make millions of dollars, and supposedly Bing Crosby was going to put him in the movies, and you know, now he'd be free to play in the U.S. Open. There weren't millions of dollars in pro golf at that time. He had to come out and do something great to back up all the statements of Grantland Rice, you know. And in the end, he was just a golfer. And the magic had gone. The things he had done had been about 4 to 5 years earlier, the big things, breaking all the course records. And he'd gotten heavier. He'd gotten older. He was about 35 years old when the trial was over. And he was a heavy, sloppy guy by then. And he got married, and he married a rich widow, so his financial situation was very good at the time. You know, there was like a John Daly quality to him, I think, that he never knuckled down and got to it. He wound up playing a bunch of exhibitions. He played in the U.S. Open once, shot in the 80s the first 2 days, and was done. He was a good golfer, but that edge, that Tiger Woods thing, you know, he went from being Tiger Woods to the 112th money winner on the tour, whose name might escape us.
Lee Montville's new book, The Mysterious Montague, A True Tale of Hollywood, Golf, and Armed Robbery, published by Doubleday, will be on a bookshelf in a bookstore near you on Tuesday. Lee, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
But I'm in my glory when wrapped in a towel, I say that it went straight down the middle. Where it wound up is a riddle. But it went straight down the middle, far away.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Catching a fish that brings $2,500 at market might seem like a fine day's work. That's what the three anglers in Hong Kong thought when they'd sold the Chinese bahaba, also known as the giant yellow croaker, which they'd landed to a local fisherman. At least until the fisherman resold the croaker, which is highly prized for its costly swim bladder, for a little over $60,000. Oh-ho! That fisherman must have laughed until he learned that the seafood restaurant, which had taken the fish off his hands, had resold it to a mainland Chinese buyer for $126,000. And then the 5.5-foot-long fish came back to life and ate all the people who'd bought and sold him and ate the money as well. I made that last part up. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, they say the lanes are always bright on Broadway. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie. And he's obviously in the mood for the discussion we're going to have today. Big Truck. I like Big Truck. I like the possibility that the nation's most famous horse race, the Kentucky Derby, set to go this afternoon, gets won by Big Truck. 50-1 on the morning line. What do you think?
I like big trucks, and I cannot lie. No, I'm sorry. That's not the one I'm going for.
Oh.
I'm going to go purely on ethnographic grounds with Dennis of Cork,
Which
nice. Reminds me of Tim the Enchanter somehow.
All right.
Who's going off at a slightly lower price than I like big trucks, and I cannot lie, is going off it.
The favorite is Big Brown. If either Big Truck or Big Brown were a filly and they produced a colt, would the colt be called Big Brown Truck?
No, I think the colt would probably be called UPS.
I just put the softballs up there, and you whack
them. It's a long drive. Way back. He wants that one back, ladies and gentlemen.
Byron Scott, whose stint as coach of the New Orleans Hornets began with an 18-64 season and included 2 years when the team played its home games in Oklahoma City, was named NBA Coach of the Year this week. Nice career arc, huh?
Yeah, utterly no argument on this one. He produced a terrific team, a team that's already won a playoff series. Not that this matters on his Coach of the Year thing. Within social and cultural and urban circumstances under which nobody has ever put a sports team together the way he did. He did get lucky that Chris Paul has turned out to be the player he is. Nonetheless, this is the least arguable postseason award of the year.
On the other end of the coaching ladder, Avery Johnson fell victim to Mark Cuban's impatience when the Dallas Mavericks lost in the first round of the playoffs. Was that failure really Avery Johnson's fault?
Well, you know, far be it for me to argue with the world's smartest human, Mark Cuban. But I think he's a little quick on the trigger here. On the other hand, Avery Johnson had pretty plainly lost this team. It wasn't going to get any better in the offseason. Cuban's big mistake, of course, is not realizing that the window has closed on this particular group of Dallas Mavericks. From the time they were up 2-0 over the Miami Heat a couple of years ago, I think they've won 9 playoff games total. This bunch, Dirk Nowitzki, this whole crew, it's time to break it up and start again.
Larry Brown has returned to the NBA coaching ranks, courtesy of Charlotte Bobcats managing member of basketball operations, Michael Jordan. How do you like that partnership?
Well, this whole thing is just the Dean Smith Jedi mind trick. I mean, they're all linked to like each other and support each other and give each other jobs. Larry Brown's got some players down there. He's got some stuff to work with on that team. They'll be a really good team next year. That's an early prediction.
Charlie, it's not unusual to hear that a player has carried a team. The aforementioned Michael Jordan used to do it regularly. However, it is pretty unusual for a team, in this case the opposing team, to carry a player. Would you care to explain how that happened this week?
Yeah, there was a softball game between the Western Oregon University and Central Washington University, playing, I believe, in the Rand McNally Conference. And Sarah Tucholsky of Western Oregon hit her first home run ever, realized she'd missed first base, went back to tag it, and somehow blew her knee out.
Right.
And two Central Washington players picked her up and carried her around the base pass. Now, I'm not entirely sure this is legal.
Well, they checked it out. This is an interesting story. It's not legal for your own teammates to help you, but the opposing players said, "Hey, ump, is it okay if we help her?" And the ump said, "There's no rule against that."
Well, good for him.
And the team that carried this kid around the bases lost the game.
They did.
Yeah.
They'll never do this again, by God.
No justice after all.
This will never happen again. No one will ever do this again.
Charlie, former Dodgers executive Buzzy Bavezzi died on Thursday. He was 93 years old. He is credited with assembling 4 World Series winners, but he contributed a good deal more to baseball than that.
Yeah, he was the connective tissue between Brooklyn and Los Angeles. He was the connective tissue between Jackie Robinson and Davey Lopes. He was the continuous part of the Dodger franchise that wasn't universally hated the way Walter O'Malley was. He was the guy who gave Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb a shot after Jackie Robinson. He was the one who eased their way into L.A., at least in part by putting together a good team that L.A. could attach itself to. Yeah, he's a giant in the history of a very important franchise.
New allegations of extramarital affairs involving Roger Clemens were made public this week. Do you think Clemens has begun to rethink the wisdom of claiming that his former trainer, Brian McNamee, sullied Clemens' reputation?
This is one of those stories that keeps unfolding, and I keep feeling like David Hedison at the end of The Fly. Help me! Help me! Help me! Yes, I think that the defamation suit that Roger Clemens has filed against Brian McNamee is probably the dumbest legal action in my memory. Stop suing people, Roger. Bad idea.
The globalization of the National Football League took another step forward, or at least a step sideways this week. Is it safe to conclude that the Buffalo Bills, who will play 8 games in Toronto over the next 5 years, are delighted with the mathematics of this move?
They're getting $78 million, which is double their operating income from 2006, to play 8 games in Toronto over the next 5 years. I suspect that this is greasing the skids in a big way to the eventual Toronto Bills.
Elsewhere in the NFL, though, Jason Taylor of the Miami Dolphins has become a star on Dancing with the Stars, the TV show where his routine has included some football moves, as in touchdown at the end of his performance. His boss back in Miami is apparently not impressed. What does Bill Parcells have against twinkling toes?
Jason Taylor, who wants out of town pretty badly, and Bill Parcells, who is adamant against what he calls players shooting their way out of town, which is basically committing work stoppages until they get what they want, is not happy that instead of coming to preseason workouts, Jason has gone on to do his Terpsichorean thing on TV. And apparently, when Jason Taylor showed up at the Miami facility, Bill Parcells didn't even look at him.
Unlike millions of people watching television,
that's right.
He's utterly enchanted them. And finally, we return to the subject of the day, the Kentucky Derby, for this story of actually sad news regarding attempts to convince the winner of the 2002 Kentucky Derby to do his part in producing future champions.
This is odd, just reading the story, as I thought we were returning to the Roger Clemens story.
No, it has nothing to do with
it. Yeah, War Emblem apparently has lost his mojo and is disinclined to make little War Emblems, which is sort of like what his only job is going to be for the rest of his life. And his Japanese owners are quite at sea as to what to do about it. As one of them says, it's very odd. He's not impotent. He's just very choosy about his women. He's more human than animal. Basically, he's a bit of a weirdo. See what happens in this materialistic, sex-obsessed, sex-drenched, hormonal tide that we're in? A guy doesn't want to be promiscuous, and he gets called a weirdo by his boss. Where the hell are we going to?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Sunday Boston Globe magazine. He also joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Mr. Saturday Dance, they crowded the floor. It's awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
But nevertheless, why stir up memories been invited on dates?
Bowling, long known for its restorative qualities amongst professionals of all types, is currently providing rest and relaxation for a group of New Yorkers who, though less familiar with the rumble of the lanes and the crashing of the pins than they are with the smell of the grease paint and the roar of the crowd, have taken to the lanes as energetically as they have taken to the Broadway stage. Only a Game's Michelle Seaton recently had a front row center ticket, and she has this report.
It's disco night at the Leisure Time Bowling Alley in New York City's Port Authority bus terminal. By 11 p.m., the alley has just about cleared out the night's recreational bowlers. The bouncer out front begins to welcome actors and crew members from nearly two dozen Broadway shows. They have all just finished their Thursday night performances and have come straight to the lanes for the weekly Broadway Show Bowling League. The teams play a standard round-robin rotation, two games per night, and probably won't finish until after 2:30 in the morning. Valerie Peterson is the stage manager for Mike Leigh's new play, 2,000 Years. She explains why late-night bowling makes sense for her and her coworkers.
We're night owls. You know, everybody says, you bowl at 11:30 at night? And we're like, yeah, that's when I get out of work. I don't go to bed until 3. I don't wake up until 11. You know? So it's perfect for us.
Peterson's team is called 100% Recycled because it's made up of stage managers and stagehands from several different shows, both on and off Broadway. She says this league is their one chance to get together each week.
You know, it's hard in New York to see your friends all the time, especially when you work in theater and you work at night, every night. You miss out on a lot of stuff. You can't go to happy hour with your friends. You can't go to movies with your friends. You can't go to all the parties that your friends are having. And so this is perfect for us.
But why bowling? Noah Racy, who stars in the musical Curtains and wears a lucky fedora on the lanes, says that anyone who has to ask that question doesn't understand what he calls the true power of bowling.
The ball, the throwing it, it hitting the pins, and the screaming. There's lots of screaming. Yeah, it's just a fun night. Every, you know, once a week we all meet up here and get to go bowling.
And drink beer.
And drink beer and eat pizza and have a good time.
Racy's team is called the Drapes, because it is made up of the cast and crew of a show called Curtains. Many of the team names make reference to specific shows. The cast and crew of Avenue Q make up a team called Sucks to Be Q. Cast members of the musical Grease are the Ramalama Ding Dongs. The Legally Blonde production has a team called Legally Blind. Other team names make reference to beer, drinking beer, or being drunk.
We're drunk and
wow.
Can you say that on NPR?
I hope so.
Yeah, you might have some trouble tonight.
There was one team a few years ago that was for villain.
They're still here.
Oh, really? Yeah. Can't say that one.
Really? No, I guess not. They're still here.
Or bold now.
They're still here.
Yeah, okay. No.
In lane 20, a group of Irish actors from the play The Seafarer are warming up and eyeing their competition in the next lane. In the theater, this cast is playing to rave reviews and standing ovations. But in the bowling alley, they are at a bit of a cultural disadvantage. Ask actor Kieran Hines, born and raised in Belfast, what his handicap is, and he shakes his head.
Oh, I have no idea. I don't even know what it means. I mean, I suppose somebody explained it to us, but we just turn up and play and drink some beer and play bowls and abuse the people who are playing against us, you know, verbally, not physically.
Later, Hines admits that breaking 100 would be a first for him. In fact, he may need to pool his score with another team member in order to break 100. Not that winning matters to any of them. They're actors, after all. If you can't hit any pins, you can at least add some flourish, says Hines.
But we all want to be John Turturro from The Big Lebowski, but we just don't have the nerve to start slinking around and doing all that stuff. But maybe later on we'll get throw in a bit of style.
Actor Sean Mann, who also stars in The Seafarer, admits that he's not much of a bowler. Mann is from Dublin, and this is his first Broadway play. He says he joined the bowling team in part to get the full Broadway experience. The trouble with bowling, he says, is that not only can he not figure out what he's doing wrong, he can't quite figure out what he's doing right.
I'm just in it for the laugh, basically. But I got very lucky. The first time I played, I bowled a 166. I got a turkey, which is three strikes in a row. But then after that, I kind of bowled like a 100, so it wasn't... It's certainly not strategy. It's more the look of the game, basically.
Tonight, the Seafarer faces the team from the musical Mary Poppins, called the Poppin' Pins. No actors or front-of-the-house folks on that team. It's all burly backstage crew, some of whom wear leather vests over their bowling shirts.
Come on, Mike. Knock them all down, baby.
Yeah.
All right. Gutter spare?
Yeah.
The hard way. Spare the hard way, baby.
The serious teams aren't hard to pick out. There's no one who's still wearing glittery stage makeup or funny hats. No one is doing Rockette-style kicks after a surprising strike. The serious bowlers have matching shirts with names embroidered on the front and logos on the back. These folks have tournament-quality bowling bags. They bring their own shoes. They spend time taping their fingers. They have no sense of humor about losing or about winning, for that matter.
We won the first game. We took the first game big time.
This, according to John Martinez, of the team that calls itself Will Bowl for Beer.
We're in first place right now. We were second place last year. Our team branched off. We originally were the one huge team that everybody wanted to be in, so we spawned a second team. So now we have Will Bowl for Beer 2, T-O-O, and we enjoy it.
The wait staff in this bowling alley has kept plenty busy, shuttling chicken wings, nachos, and serving giant glass cylinders of beer called Powers, each one of which has its own tap. As the night wears on, the bowling declines in quality, but the bonding increases.
We'll bowl! We'll roll for beer!
The bowling league runs from early January to early June, when many of the shows close. Then the fall season starts up again after the summer, when a new theater season begins. The league used to run year-round, but the commissioners decided to shorten the seasons and to allow more flexibility among team players. After all, says league co-commissioner Amber Whedon, the Broadway community is always in flux.
But we allow for people to kind of come in and go as much as they need. And the teams are bigger than six people. They'll have rotating members who want to come in and bowl for them each night, which is good.
Whedon herself has had to miss several months of bowling.
I went away. I did a show in Toronto for a couple months called White Christmas. It's funny because we all kind of freelance people. We do a show for a while, and then your show will go on the road or come back. So it creates a lot of uncertainty in the league with who's going to be around.
But that uncertainty also creates energy. Players never know who is going to turn up, who they will see or play against, or for that matter, who won't turn up because their show has gone on the road or because they've given up on theater and taken a day job. Still, for those who do make it on Thursday night, the Broadway bowling party rolls on. For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton in New York City.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcast, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from our mystery Broadway bowler. I think that was Nathan Lane. Lane, see, get it? Lane. I bet that knocked you right off your pins. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'm terribly sorry. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.